Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tapped Into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. And with us today is a bioethicist, a professor of applied health sciences from the University of Western Ontario. Ken Kirkwood, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you guys?
We're pretty fantastic, actually. Right. Beautiful rainy day, hanging out in the summertime, having a conversation. So part of, you know, what you teach and stuff is sort of the history of drug use. And that can extend throughout history, through North America and so forth. And so I figured an interesting place to start this conversation would be sort of, why do we use drugs and where did this start and how is this progressing into society? And then perhaps a look at where we are today.
Mm. I mean, I think it's an essential of human condition, right? We've always sought to alter our consciousness. It goes way back. I mean, people have theorized that it goes back to cavemen and so forth. But obviously somebody somewhere figured out that, for example, vegetation that ferments is something you want to consume, right? It comes to us now. And fungi and other things that we consume presently had an origin somewhere, right? And I mean, basically, nature creates toxins to try and defend itself. And we discovered as humans that, hey, little bits of it don't kill us, but make us feel better about ourselves or change the way we perceive our world. And that's a thing. And it's universal too. I mean, prior to colonization, every culture had this connection to it, right? And it has this tie into religion as well, right? But humans have always altered their consciousness. They've always wanted to see things a different way or found out that there's a different way to see things or perceive things. And that's just, drugs have been an essential element of that going way back before into prehistory.
Well, and I find it interesting too, is that, you know, the fact that humans have this desire to do it, even in a lot of senses, outweighs the risks. Because like you were talking about, you know, these are toxins by very definition. Mm-hmm. And so how many people have died in the process of determining the amounts? And the fact that humans have this continual drive to augment their consciousness to the point where they're risking life mm-hmm. is actually quite profound.
Yeah, but you know, I think that's just part of the human condition. We, you know, imagine, you know, existing a certain way and knowing, you know, perceiving things a certain way, and then you find out that there's another way to perceive things, or there's other reality or seemingly reality out there to perceive. Humans are naturally going to be driven to do that, to push that. And of course, it's trial and error. And in New York, what we're talking about here is an error that's fatal. But then it modulates, right? People realize, oh, that was too much. And they kind of dial it back. And now they have we've developed over centuries, millennia, a sophisticated gauge of how much to consume, basically, to achieve a certain goal. And now anybody who takes drugs can tell you, basically, this is too intense, and this is enough, and this is not quite enough. And, you know, they have their own intuitive scale about, depending on what they're trying to achieve too, right? From anything from microdosing to people who maybe overuse, if we'll say.
Well, and a part of that too is, you know, like you were talking about, like psychedelics are one thing for altering your conscious state, but, you know, alcohol, like we've had a very interesting relationship with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people actually argue that the agricultural revolution was less about bread and more about the production of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that our entire civilization, as we know it, was basically based on people coming together to brew alcohol. And those old alcoholic beverages, more often than not, would be medicinal, psychedelic, have a lot of other components in them as well.
Yeah, alcohol had a tradition of being a performance-enhancing drug. In barn-raising bees and stuff like that, alcohol was a necessity. You had to provide that because people believed, and physiologically you can get this. It's an easily digestible carbohydrate that alters your perception of effort and so forth. But it used to be, you know, required. It was like performance food, right? It was like the performance diet. You got to have lots of beer. You got to have lots of alcohol to basically fuel people to raise the barn. And we have lots of established historical record of this.
And another interesting thing too is that in the process of fermentation, it actually makes like water safe. You know what I mean? So as opposed to dying of all sorts of waterborne pathogens, you know, alcohol played a very significant role in just staying alive, let alone for augmentation of consciousness.
Yeah, the water supply was terrible most of history, basically, right? So yes, beer was a safer version. Imagine beer is the health food and water is deadly.
And you know, another thing I find interesting, like I've done a lot of reading on this, is that, you know, people always have this weird idea that religion itself is integral to humanity, and it very well might be, but the basis of most, if not all, religions themselves stem from psychedelic use in one way or another. And you look back to like animistic sort of religious hunter-gatherer tribes and everything, and pretty much anywhere you go in the world, like you were saying before, is that there is evidence of indigenous psychedelic use, whether that's mushroom, cactus, you know, some sort of fungus. And like, there's even a fish that has psychedelic properties in the Mediterranean, which is quite fascinating, right? So it seems that wherever you go, people are drawn to this, and from that construct these religions that eventually become monopolized, unfortunately. But, you know, like, what's your insight on that?
You know, the idea of altering your consciousness, so whether through drugs it's or through belief in a deity or deities. The point is that basically humans are have never been satisfied with the mundane practical reality of their existence. So there's always something more. And there was an anthropologist named Brown who did a sort of a review of all the anthropological literature that we have and said, like, what are the commonalities? So, you know, anthropologists in the 1800s and 1900s went off to islands untouched by colonialism, trying to find out what these folks believed or how they lived and their culture. And in the process of doing that, you know, you do that enough hundreds of times, you start to see, like, hey, are there any commonalities, independent of exported ideas through colonialism, that humans shared? Because maybe that's a sense of human nature or commonalities. And sure enough, you know, no culture believes that when you die, that's the end, right? There's always this sense. Everybody independently has had this idea that there has to be more than just you and I sitting here. There has to be something else. You die, there has to be some other existence after that. I think that probably speaks to humans' inclination to not think that this is the only reality and there's something greater and something more powerful existing. And, you know, drugs perform the same function independently. Now, when you put them together, drugs like this, psychedelics, have served as sacraments for lots of religions, right? The idea is you have this God who you can't see, but is everywhere. We'll take the Christian religion, for example, right? If God is everywhere, then you must be able to, you know, but we can't perceive him. Lots of people, it is more in the 20th century, came up with the idea that, hey, maybe psychedelics don't delude us. It's not an illusion or a delusion of what's happening, but maybe it's opening up what's actually real to us. You know, and this is a way to interact with God. So they call them entheogens. And these are drugs that are used. They're basically the idea that drugs allow you to experience God, whatever, however you would conceive who God is. And it's been subject of some famous experiments or famous episodes. Like in the 1961 in Boston, Houston Smith, who's a theologian, famous theologian, he and some other people got together at Good Friday, and they call it the Good Friday Experiment, if you ever want to look this one up. And basically, they took psilocybin and attended a Good Friday service to see if they could actually, they first of all, believing that God is real and God is present, they felt that the drug would remove the kind of impediments that they naturally have to experience God directly, and that this drug would allow them to then experience God directly. That had some interesting outcomes to it, because, of course, drugs are set and setting, right? So it's your mindset, and then the setting in which you're taking them has a big impact on your experience. So you have people who are very pious taking drugs, thinking that they're going to get a chance to experience God in a way that they never have before. So some of them wigged out. There is a story. It was a university experiment. So there's graduate students, of course, there trying to, you know, referee this thing, make sure it doesn't go off the rails. They ended up chasing somebody. It was at the chapel at Boston University. So apparently one of them had to go chase one of the worshipers out into the street and keep them out of traffic because they'd had such a powerful experience of directly seeing God or experiencing God in a direct way. And it blew their mind. It freaked them out. And they ran around. So you have this. So, I mean, this is a pursuit that we've done forever, but it even has some modern day, you know, elements to it. And yeah, so, I mean, it could be either the same thing, often overlapping, or it's independent, you know, it's driven by the same motivation, but independent pursuits.
Well, and does that sort of tie into the notion of Christian Gnosticism, where you have sort of people with Christian beliefs and sort of experimenting with compounds to sort of augment their belief structure? And, you know, it's, have you read the book called The Immortality Key?
Yeah, I have.
See, I, you know, really good book, but mm-hmm. it was definitely an academic who wrote it. Mm-hmm. And but you get through it. And I found that whole thing absolutely fascinating. And I like the fact that a lot of it was very much substantiated. Like, he went to great efforts to sort of show where his findings were, and that Paleo-Christianity itself was most likely sort of an extension of Eleusinian mysteries in Athens, which was basically LSD experiences mm-hmm. using ergoline. And so I find it kind of funny is that, you know, you look at these modern day religions and the extension of the fact that most likely all of them did start with sort of psychedelic based cults. And even like the mysteries themselves, bringing it back to the idea of seeing God, is like their fundamental philosophy. And this isn't just a bunch of weird esoteric people in Athens doing this. No. These are emperors, Plato, Cicero. Like, Cicero stated once that the best thing to ever come out of Athens was the mysteries. Mm. And these are like statesmen and the fathers of democracy, as we see, like modern culture and modern thought. And these people were going into these ceremonies. And the idea, in my understanding, you know, it was a mystery, was that, to truly live, you need to die. And that the only way to truly value life is having a contrast of dying in these, you know, psychedelic states. And I've done large amounts of psychedelics and have had ego deaths, and I have physically died, electrocuted to death before, and had a death experience, which was probably endogenous DMT and a bunch of hormones and stuff. And I can completely relate to the fact that psychedelics, certain compounds, have very significant similarities to being dead. Mm. And okay, I should rephrase, I wasn't dead. Dead is I'm a corpse, but going through the process of death.
Right.
And the similarities there are so deeply significant. So to me, like, the idea of spirituality and an existence beyond what we see in this physical realm, whether that's real or not, to me has to come from psychedelic experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, don't get me wrong. Humans are creative and we're imaginative and we communicate and we do all kinds of interesting things, but we need a muse. Yeah. You know, you need to be inspired for this stuff. And that whole idea in itself, I find it that psychedelics, I sometimes wonder if who and what we are today, and if we eliminate the war on drugs, because that's only a very small segment of our continued conscious evolution, is generally shaped by psychedelic use.
There's people have intimated a bunch of different intersections, right? I mean, even it's now in the United States, of course, with the recent decision of the Supreme Court and talk about constitutionality and so forth. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the influence of ergot poisoning. So this is a mold that grows on wheat. Yep. And the suggestion was that they consumed it either intentionally or unintentionally, and it had some effect on the conceptions of the Constitution of the United States, right? Which would blow, Americans would lose their minds if they, no pun intended, about this particular possibility, right? But it's not just somebody giving out some kind of random theory to be confrontational. There's a detailed history there where in which that's a very possible scenario in which there was this idea of, like, basically creating the American Constitution while extremely high.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. And you want to start going back, you can start piling up historical record to suggest that, man, it has had a fundamental effect on human history, right? We talk about, historians like to look at the idea of, like, this pivotal moment that changed the course. You know, you could have this parallel universe, like theoretical physicists talk about, where if this didn't happen, then this other direction would be going on. And this would be the reality. It would be different from our current one because of this moment. But imagine, you know, the cumulative effect of this persistent, universal use of drugs to alter consciousness and alter thought and alter ideas. Obviously, we are the product of that environment. And it's really funny, as now, you know, we went through this phase where it was extremely prohibitive, right? I mean, now that we're starting to lighten up about these things. I mean, you know, my father could never imagine there had been cannabis shops, so many of them in a city, and be legal. Because when he was young and up to the time he died, it was still something where you went away for significant amounts of time for possessing, for example, right? So, I mean, we have changed our attitude about it in some ways. But yeah, I don't think you could write the history of humanity if you would want to try and do that project without including a chapter on here's how drugs and our chemical adventures have played a role.
So just to kind of tie into that for a second there, Ken, because you originally mentioned a little while back about how we've used substances for quite some time through history. Mm-hmm. What was the first substance that was probably used by humans in a psychogenic way?
It's speculated, of course, right? Because we can't go back. But, you know, there's discussion from ancient historians about traditions of other people, right? Mm-hmm. And they're saying things in fungus and fungi come up a lot in terms of it. So that might be, I think there's probably a good chance that probably not the first drug, but it might well be.
I would agree with that too, because I find a psilocybin mushroom, you simply just pick up and you eat it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, ayahuasca and ergoline and so forth, there's a lot of trial and error to not die. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of things, like, you know, it's these compounds that are mixed together and processed where, you know, I think there's a lot of speculation too, is that when we were sort of hunter gatherers and stuff, you'd be following herds of some sort of herbivorous mammal, and psilocybin prefers feces. Mm-hmm. And you would see them growing out and, you know, opportunistic feeding, you consume it, you have this experience. And so I, you know, mushrooms seem to be a definite origin story. And another thing too, like in Spain, there's these caves that are one of the earliest areas that have actual depictions of like people's hands and so forth. And I believe there's also like sort of mushroom or suggested mushroom imagery within there too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have the ancient Greeks, when the ancient Olympics started, some of them used fungi, psychedelic fungi, as a performance enhancing drug. And that was an idea that came to them from ancient histories passed on from before then. The idea was like, you know, people literally learned from history thousands of years ago where they said, hey, I'm doing an endurance event. It's long, it's arduous, it's boring. Hey, if I do a little bit of this, it might make it less boring, less arduous. And, you know, sure enough, we have a record that that's in fact something that they did.
Well, and that's funny too, is like, you know, indigenous tribes in the Amazon rainforest will actually augment themselves for hunting and night hunting, because psychedelics will increase your senses and dilate your pupils. Mm-hmm. And so they will take them out for dusk, dawn, night hunting, because it actually is performance enhancing. And I believe tribes in some of the plains areas in Africa will actually take sort of DMT containing plants, make these brews to assist them in lion hunting, and actually different hunts will have different brews. And so it's funny that you mentioned that with the Greeks and Olympus, because I had no idea. That's kind of cool actually, but it does seem like outside of expanding consciousness and this desire to experience different realities perhaps, that they've been utilized almost completely in whatever capacity they can. And speaking of like ergot was actually used as a medicine too, for, I believe, stopping like postpartum hemorrhaging, and because it causes vasoconstriction. Yeah. And now, mind you, that can you push that too far and you'll have a very, very, very painful death.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was like this, feel like psychedelics have been so integrated within us. And I think it's something interesting to say is that I read this book a long time ago called Intoxication by Casey Gow.
Okay.
And he talks about intoxication in the animal kingdom. And so we like to think we have the monopoly on, you know, drug use and stuff. But there's, you know, dolphins irritating puffer fish to sort of get themselves in tetrodotoxin, mongoose, elephants, porcupines. You know, it's really interesting. And, you know, like, you know, when our sort of closer simian relatives regularly use psychedelics, like psilocybin, elephants will actually unearth ibogaine plants. And the thing, too, is like this is not accidental. Like elephants are highly intelligent, they're self-aware. Right. And to get to the inner root bark of the ibogaine tree is a task, and it's a learned behavior, and they will consume it. They do it individually so that the rest of them can protect them. You know, there's even, you know, circumstances of mongooses after hurricanes in Hawaii consuming morning glory as a means to sort of reset themselves.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder, is that animals, that's an interesting statement, so higher functioning mammals, let's say dolphins and elephants, that have emotional capacities and intellect that, you know, rival humans on some level, will do it for recreation, whereas lower functioning mammals do it primarily as a response to stress.
I'll double down on that. There's a statement of theory in psychology, and it makes some sense too. And people who study animal behavior, right, that the desire to alter your consciousness is a sign of intelligence, right? So, and everybody does this, right? I mean, coffee is everywhere. People, even in small fashions, people are always doing things to alter their consciousness. And it may be a sign of a higher level of intellect. You know, people in philosophy and ethics, we try to distinguish between animals and humans, and where do the rights of people extend to, right? That's a very popular, so people who are animal rights people tend to say like animals are more like humans than we give them credit for and they should be treated more like that. So that's just an academic point. But one of the behaviors, when you start saying like, well, what behaviors do animals and humans have in common? You can see like, oh, that the higher order mammals, the ones that we typically talk about in terms of having emotions, having human-like qualities, and maybe we should treat them more like humans, the desire to alter their consciousness through other means, exogenous means, is a real thing. And I think that, so I think you can probably say that. And certainly, before he became an eccentric celebrity, Timothy Leary did award-winning psychological work for the American Psychological Association. He won awards. He was a mainstream academic who had huge accolades early on until he got a little bit involved with himself. And he, part of his theory was like, well, look, this is a behavior in nature that exists amongst all the highest order mammals, including humans, but also including elephants and primates and so forth. So it's an interesting statement to make because it seems to be borne out in the literature.
Now, Ken, why is that it's mostly predominantly found in higher order functioning mammals that they're using psychedelics in this way? Is it to kind of cut out the noise of having this awareness of the environment? Is it to increase the awareness of the environment? Like, has anybody talked about why it is that this theory exists?
There's hypotheses out there, of course, but one of them would be, to me, seems like one is most plausible, is that, look, if you're smart, if you're aware at a level beyond just base functioning, then you start asking questions like, what the hell is this we're doing here? What's going on? Why are we here? Those kind of questions come up. And over through the history of philosophy, they always said, well, this is why humans are different from other, going back to the Greeks, right? Why is a cow not the equivalent of a human? And part of it was like, well, humans can ask questions like that. And cows go, I want to breed. I have to defecate. I have to eat. Repeat. Right? Their thought process is very basic. But humans, we have these intense thoughts. Like you can have a discussion about, you know, is our whole existence being in God's fishbowl? And all these things that we've thought of over the history. We have that. But I think the byproduct of having that level of functioning, part of it is like wanting to know what difference in perception is going to be part of that, right? Like, is this all there is? That's a classic question, existential question. Is this all there is? Is this experience everything there is? And that's why independently, every culture created some kind of spirituality, whether you're being reincarnated, whether you go to heaven, hell, what have you. All, you know, we have those, humans created those because we can't be satisfied with accepting the possibility that this is all there is.
Well, and I think that consciousness in itself is sort of a double-edged sword. You know what I mean? Like, it's the fact that we can muse about these theoretical situations and philosophize about the meaning of existence both gives us hope and provides this sense of despair. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, an interesting quote that makes me think of is that, you know, to get rid of the pain of being a man, one must make a beast out of himself. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea that, you know, we have to augment ourselves. We have to push forward, whether it's alcohol, this, and, you know, whether it's an expression of self-destruction or a desire to become greater than one perceives themselves. It all plays into the same thing. Yeah. You know, I don't think people are generally content. You know, Samuel Beckett said that, well, now we're happy. What do we do?
Yeah. What do we do now that we are happy? Exactly.
Like we're in this position. So what do we have to do? And again, happiness is very deeply subjective. You know, I think that we now exist in a world that is far safer than the one that our ancestor existed in before by a level of just literal threat. But then, you know, you look at the environment we live in now with social media, you have advertising companies designed to make us feel bad about ourselves so that we will inadvertently and emotionally buy products. Like we live in an era of absolute manipulation. And then, you know, you look at in the 60s and 70s when sort of this war on drugs really started. And I think the war on drugs, and I could be wrong, you would know far more about this, was sort of as a response to sort of like anti-war sentiment. People are freaking out. Society's destabilizing. It's LSD. We have to do something about it. And then we just had this blank area. And then just unrepentant capitalism that just led to where we are now. And I'm probably cynical. I'm 40. I grew up without phones and computers, but I think social media started off perhaps, you know, a little bit benevolent, but now has turned into this monster.
I think that you're right. The you know, think about the history of psychedelics just in the 20th century, right? I mean, it started to gain mainstream traction because the U.S. government and other governments felt like it had a military application. And so the experiments at McGill under Ewan Cameron all were driven by not helping humanity, like helping people with mental health problems, or the focus now. The focus then was like, hey, could you destabilize a spy sufficiently that you could get information, critical information from them that would help the West beat the East in this Cold War? That was the focus. It was not the benefit of humans in any kind of health sense. It was purely a military government kind of operation. That's well documented in the record. It's not a question. And, you know, but at some point, and then, you know, it started to have some medical applications with Leary and the crowd at Harvard studying this. And this is great. But it, as soon as it started leaking out of not having those kind of not having a military application, it really started to fall out of favor. And basically then the prohibition comes in, right? And we've lost, 60 years worth of research because of, you know, how Leary represented himself in the research first. I mean, in some ways, but basically the political will had left, right? Yeah. To support that research anyway. So it became a, you know, we can't study this. And for decades, at least, operations like MAPS and others have been lobbying for research. There were some kernels of really good stuff in that research, early research, that was cut off. And we've waited this long to even start resuming it. And I think there is some promise in the medication. There's a promise in the drug for people, especially given the current context like you're talking about in terms of mental health problems.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned Leary, and I completely agree with that. Like Leary, I read up in quite a bit. He started off, he had all these accolades, all this research, and then he just kind of became megalomaniac. and he became this very visible, very vocal threat to the American government. And, you know, when we're talking about military applications and stuff, I think it's an appropriate moment to talk about the MKUltra project. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've read quite a bit of books on it, and I feel like it's kind of started with post-Korean War and the notion of brainwashing someone. Mm-hmm. You know, this brainwashing, you know, they've been taken, they've been augmented psychologically. Are they double agents? Are they spies? What have they told? No one knows. And started using LSD and to sort of unravel this person, I think, which was the impetus for it. Mm-hmm. And then very rapidly it turned into something else. Like I don't suppose you read the book called Chaos, the Secret History of the 60s.
No.
Oh my God, you got to read that.
Okay, that's on the list now. It was a military idea. And, you know, I can see what's happening right there. They're having this enemy of longstanding capacity, like they could exist for a long time. It was a lot of countries together against the West. And you're trying to, the secrecy level was pretty significant. And you're trying to find a way to break down spies. Like you capture spies. They have a trove of information. They also have a trove of techniques that are taught to them how not to divulge any information, right? To distract themselves against torture and all this kind of thing. Not that, obviously, you can't get through torture unscathed, but enough to prevent you from caving in the head. They teach people this stuff, right? But so what you want to do is you want to trick them. You want to try and distort their reality such that they lose track of what the things they learned, right? So this was the purpose of the research. And it was just barbaric. I mean, historians have this discussion all the time about, you know, well, you can't judge the past by present standards. You'd have to put, you know, they call it presentism, right? The idea that you would look back at whatever, any historical phenomenon and judge it the way we look at it now. But the way to judge it is to look at what people are saying at the time. Like, were there, you know, is this a completely foreign concept to those people at this time? You know, Greek slavery, for example, slaveholding in Greece, for example. You can say, well, that's barbaric and terrible. And yeah, of course. But at the time, what's their perception of it? Well, the perception of operations like at McGill and so forth is that it was barbaric for its time, right? That's why it was secretive. It was protected, so that's why it can go on the way it did. But there's people who say, like, well, that was a different time and so forth. It's like, yeah, okay, it was, but not that different. It, you know, that was not permitted. There was some pretty bad research that happened. It was pretty unethical. We, you know, there's books and books about stuff that's been pulled on seniors, on people who have mental deficiencies and all that kind of thing. There's lots of that. But there's no way that the stuff that went on at McGill was ever going to be allowed except under the auspices of, you know, secrecy and American military and Canadian compliance with that.
Well, wasn't the Unabomber theoretically part of sort of being drugged in the MKUltra project, and you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, there's a lot of speculation with that. Yes, yeah,
yeah, considerable amounts. And you know, in the MKUltra project too, like, it's, I totally agree with that concept that if people feel the need to cover something up that obviously is unethical, and whether they sort of try and suggest it was, you know, top secret because of military reasons or whatever, at the same time, like, you know, they were doing experiments on American citizens without their knowledge. Mm-hmm. Like, there was like Midnight Climax, which is sort of a weird sort of esoteric thing where they would actually had a brothel. Mm-hmm. And these scientists would sit behind a two-way mirror drinking scotch.
Well, classic honeypot.
Right. Really, though.
Really?
Yeah. And you would have a prostitute or a lady of the night. And the targets, so to speak, or John, or whatever you want to call him, would be given LSD. And then it would be sort of this whole process of what kind of information they could get out of them.
Yeah.
And you're like, interesting. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's, and that to me is sort of like a more of a comedic sort of thing. And then you get into the sort of the darker part of it. Mm. And then almost to the ludicrous. Like, I think there was Jolly Roger was an Air Force commander in the Korean War. And he started sort of taking over parts of the MKUltra project. Arguably headed it. And there was one point where they were going to give an elephant LSD and he screwed up on the dosing and killed the elephant.
Yeah. How much LSD do you give an elephant? That's a great question.
What is it with scientists and elephants? Like Edison?
You know? Yeah, fair enough. Well, you know, I feel like elephants, they're highly intelligent. They have memories. They're self-aware. They recognize themselves in a mirror. Like, you know, and you're looking at equivalencies to humans. You know, you could go right to chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are pretty reasonable for that, but elephants are pretty on par too.
So aside from this tangent that we're going on about elephants.
it's hilarious what he's talking about.
I do want to cycle back though, because Ken, you were mentioning something about McGill University, like here in Canada, when Adam's talking about MKUltra. Mm-hmm. I am not familiar with any of the stuff that you're talking about or alluding to. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. There was psychedelic research, LSD research conducted at McGill. There was in the 1990s, there was a whole final apology exposure of documents, that kind of thing about it. And it was funded by the CIA. This is not bizarre conspiracy podcast. This is legitimate historical record. Basically to destabilize, same kind of motivation, right? Can you destabilize people in their defense mechanisms against sharing information? So basically it's counter-espionage methodology. And it was Ewan Cameron was the psychiatrist who ran the studies. They were top secret. And basically what came out of it was nothing of any value, but lots of really severely damaged people. And it was subject to multiple lawsuits. There's a movie called The Sleep Room about it. There's documentaries you can look up on CBC, for example. Basically it was this really black history, moment of history. And then, you know, we ask the same questions about that as we do at MKUltra and other times where experiments happened about, you know, how did this happen? Who knew? And so forth. But the level of secrecy put into this thing, you know, Dr. Cameron had carte blanche. He had a higher authority than, say, the McGill people that he was answering to. So a lot of stuff was allowed to occur because people were kept out of the loop in part. And then I'm sure there's lots of look the other way that happens. That's a classic phenomenon as well, where, you know, I'm not asking what's happening there because I know the money's flowing through. So I'm sure it's taken care of, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm wondering where that moment in great Canadian history commercial is.
Yeah. People screaming and doctors standing over the minister in LSD. They'll be like, yeah.
People are put in comas for days and days and days.
Yeah,
you know, at the level, like beyond toxic, basically sustaining them medically to endure more drug use. I mean, the level of barbarity is shocking.
Not far off Mengele in World War II and stuff like that. I didn't realize that was the extent of it. And the fact that we're doing it to our own citizens, you know, with some sort of, like you say, higher authority somehow justifying it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is for the greater good of security and so forth. But I find something interesting is that, you know, we were talking about psychedelic use in our past, religious, ceremonial, symbolic, and then all of a sudden we get into this military application of it. Mm. And I find it fascinating that our species have been using psychedelics and these compounds for arguably 10,000 years. And I can't imagine that back in the, you know, Greek wars and so forth, that they were taking, you know, soldiers from the side and dosing them and interrogating them and waterboarding them. So it's funny how at some point we took these things that meant so much to us spiritually and then turned them into sort of a weapon. And that says a lot for, I don't know if you want to call it desperation or opportunism or just who and what we are as a species, but it's sort of an interesting hard left. You know what I mean?
And the war, you know, war is like a fundamental human experience too, right? Unfortunately. And in the process of that, of conducting war, people have tried all kinds of different things to be better at it, right? The performance enhancement comes in war as well and comes from wars and military applications. So, you know, during the Crusades, right, the Christian crusaders had sent reports of the Turkish infidels and using hashish to make them super warriors. Yeah. And, you know, so this became a, you know, the idea was that they were doing this. And the Christian crusaders had to fight against this. I mean, and I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that this is a thing that's been in the imagination. It wasn't like a completely unbelievable concept. It was something that they shared, like as a performance-enhancing drug for war. I mean, I find that highly, of course.
Doesn't the term assassin actually come from that itself? Assassin?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, I was reading about that. It was interesting that it was sort of like an Islamic mysticism where they would go and hashish to put them in these states. Now, I don't know, I've smoked hash before, and I can tell you that all I want to do is eat some food and sit in a hammock. I'm not sure if I want to go engage in barbaric warfare.
Yeah, you know, I think anybody who's ever bounced in a bar, as I have for a long time, you know, people drunk versus people high, there's no comparison in terms of the percent, you know, the possibility of violence. It's like drunk people, you're going to have to wrestle all night long. People who are high, it's a night off.
Give them some fries and gravy.
I would argue it depends on the drug. People hop on cocaine.
We're not talking about blow. That guy who's jacked up on meth for 3 days, he is so nice. I think we're just specifically talking about cannabinoids at this point. And another interesting thing too, like we were talking about the notion of warfare being augmented by psychedelics, and you can look at Viking berserkers as well, right? And there's, whether it's hensbane or it's muscalol, like Amanita muscaria mushrooms or something like that, that in itself was a very significant augmentation. Like there's, you know, stories and of Viking berserkers on some substance of some kind and then being, you know, stabbed, taking multiple wounds and just continuing to hold a bridge for like 4 hours before they just die of blood loss. And it's an interesting concept. And I went kind of down that rabbit hole too, because it interested me, like the whole fundamental principle of like Nordic and Viking psychedelic use and so forth. And I think it was in Northern Scotland, they found an area where it was an old Viking camp or so. And they found like a lot of huge amounts of hensbane in the area. And then remnants of hensbane within like these, you know, vessels and so forth. And the idea of like, you know, psychedelics being both a sacrament, a medicine, and an augment to warfare. And you could arguably suggest that Vikings warfare was part of their religion. Mm-hmm. So I guess a sacrament kind of goes both ways with that. But then, you know, you look at other religions too. And I think we had mentioned this earlier, well, just when we were talking was, you know, even in like the Rig Veda, the idea of Soma being this elixir that makes you God, brings you to God and so forth. And again, no one really knows what it is, but I feel there's a lot of speculation where it could be muscalol, it could be psilocybin, it could be some sort of psychedelic compound. And I think that, you know, originally, you know, back when it was sort of first going into modern Western, you know, philosophy and so forth, that it was sort of like, you know, scoffed at. But I think that even as it progressed, it's become quite likely that even the idea of Hinduism itself is very much perpetuated by psychedelic use.
Yeah. There's the intertwining between religion and drugs there's a significant world history, right? I mean, it just ties back into this sort of seemingly human drives that having these things sometimes independent, but sometimes merge, right? Because they naturally go together. And so it doesn't surprise me. Basically every religion, major religion has this history where there's this element of it, and people don't like to talk about it, and they don't like me to talk about it. But we can see that there's a history there, and there's an element to it for sure.
Well, and another thing too, right? Like you know, we were talking before about the mysteries and these paleo Christian cults, and then Christianity expanded from these. And then the Catholic Church very graciously, you know, started a war against women who were the predominant offerers of the sacraments. And then, and I think part of that too is like, you know, if you're going to monopolize something, you have to be the purveyor of it. You can't, it's not, it's a very terrible business model if everyone could just go out and achieve this. And, you know, you look at, you know, I say this and people get really pissy, but North America on some levels is a theology. You know what I mean? Like, it's our principles. Like, you look at the states and, you know, even the reversal of Wade versus Roe. You know what I mean? Like, that's, it's huge. And to me, it is fundamental that North America, specifically United States, is a theocracy. Europe was for quite some period of time and still is in certain areas, but people are branching off this. But unfortunately, the perpetuation of this religious belief structure in monopolizing faith, monopolizing salvation and so forth, and the Eucharist has really much spread here. And I think that really plays a huge role in the vilification of drugs. And I don't know what answer to that is. You know what I mean? Like, it's now, like, I noticed during COVID that all of a sudden on Netflix, there's like, you know, 10 documentaries on psychedelics. And some of them are actually really quite well done, showing the negative effects, the positive effects and so forth. And to me, that is such a significant cultural shift. And I hate to say that Netflix might be ushering in the psychedelic renaissance, but they're certainly assisting with this.
I think that they probably, let's dial down their credit. I would say they'd recognized a social trend that way. And now they're right on board. They're right there going with it. But I think there's been a pretty significant, even in academics, which is the sort of behind the curve on lots of things. You know, there was this, people started pushing again, research projects for ethics approvals, which is tricky, very tricky, to start looking at this, because now mental health is the thing people are talking the most about in terms of like social need that's not met. I mean, it's the buttress behind addiction. It's the thing behind homelessness. It's the thing behind crime. People are starting to recognize that connection, that correlation. So now we're saying, hey, maybe we should do something about mental health. And maybe as a consequence of that, we'll fix these other things, will get better, which is not a new observation, but people have clicked into it. So I think that then, therefore, the interest, you know, the interest is in there for medications, especially since drugs cause so many problems in society. The use of them, the things that cause the use of them, if we could deal with those, then that would probably be a societal improvement. And you know, people have been advocating for decades. We need to get back to the research we abandoned in the 60s to not maybe exactly that research, but that theme and that thread, because we might have an answer, and we might have had the answer for a long time, and we've been not allowing it to exist.
And to me, you know, I look at our current mental health system, which, you know, due to finances, due to whatever, we've been systematically dismantling it for the past, like, decade, I would say, pretty solidly. And then now with this advent of, you know, fentanyl addiction, and I've seen it. Like, I remember, I can say is that I noticed, and I could be wrong in this, that in London, the fentanyl addiction started with Oxy-Neo. And that people, you know, previous to Oxy-Neo, the only time you ever saw fentanyl was someone when, you know, they'd scrape a patch off and they'd OD because no one knew how to use it, and you'd get there and, you know, whatever.
And yeah, then or they'd make tea, right? Like, they'd steep it, they'd steal Grandma's
some
patch.
Some version of it. Yeah, and it was always, steal Grandma's patch. And dudes passed out in the basement, sometimes dead, sometimes not. And it was tragedy, but you didn't see it very frequently.
No, because we were essentially like a meth island for a little while there.
Yeah.
Like, it was just methamphetamines.
And then I think that, and again, this goes back to the notion of harm reduction and the war on drugs, was that some jackass had this idea that, you know, I don't want people injecting oxy, so I'm going to put this gelling compound in them. And then it seemed like overnight, you know, people are injecting almost everything. And there is this, people are freaking out and people are in withdrawal. And then all of a sudden heroin came in the city and heroin's expensive. And then all of a sudden someone started graciously supplying us with fentanyl. And then that just started this whole thing. And now you're seeing all these different analogs that they're being made in mass laboratories by some country that potentially is mad about the opium wars. And some people don't forget. And, you know, and I find that the solution to this was here the whole time, like you were saying. And, you know, like, right now, we, with mental health, we only really work reactively. and we give you stuff so we can tread water and hopefully figure your shit out. And then now with psychedelics, as being able to treat these underlying problems of childhood traumas, of the stress of just simply being alive in a very confusing time, I think we can move back and be actually proactive. And I think psychedelics might be a cure for living in the 21st century. Like,
yeah, you know, like there was a bunch of really good research in, you know, research and science progresses this way, right? They have the initial findings. People then get to dismember it, to get to dissect it. They analyze it. They criticize it. You fix it. You go again. You go again. You replicate until you get some kind of conclusion at the end of that that says, hey, 80 times over, this showed up as being the finding. So then it becomes closer to fact, you know. In the 60s, about 61 to 63, Leary does the Concord prison experiment. So this is taking people who are getting close, who have been in prison for a significant amount of time. They're getting ready to get out. He conducts a psychotherapy guided by psilocybin, I believe it was, to see what, see if it had an enhanced effectiveness. And all these guys, you remember now, people going into prison typically have really long histories of adverse childhood experiences, trauma galore. You know, you don't just sort of show up in prison one day. There's a whole process, a socialization process of making, you know, a society being hostile to you and your loved ones being hostile to you and so forth. So you end up at this, the conclusion of all this is you end up in prison, right? And you have a lot of precursor baggage to deal with. And then they were having significant, you know, dying and rebirth or resurrection kind of experiences, which for them makes a lot of sense, right? The idea that you die and the old you is dead. And who comes out? Somebody new comes out. There's an identity change. There's an opportunity to be redeemed, basically, using a lot of the Christian narratives, because, of course, this is happening in a Christian nation. So that narrative is overlaid here, right? That's the set, the mindset. And you're having much lower rates of recidivism and much lower rates of sort of the behavioral patterns that lead to being reincarcerated. Now, of course, that was shut down. Yeah. But, you know, what an interesting, like, imagine, because trauma is probably the number, everybody's talking about trauma-informed mental health care and so forth, right? So, I mean, what we're looking at is if it's something like that kind of experience, that death and rebirth kind of experience, that could be facilitated from some combination of psychedelics and psychotherapy, if you could facilitate that kind of thing, that might be the way forward in terms of trying to help people who have this kind of huge history of trauma.
You know, I think part of the problem with that is that I don't think the system wants to help people. You know, like in the States, like the prison penitentiary, you know, system itself, like the entire system that involves with police, penitentiaries, the supplies, this and that, is a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Right.
You know, and it's in their lobbyists, you know, and it's funny that there's a solution that could save insane amounts of money, fundamentally help people who are impoverished from lower socioeconomic levels. There's also a race component associated with that with American prison systems. And you know, there's a solution, but I just don't think they want it. I don't think they care. I think that they're happier with their beds filled in a prison than they are with them not.
Yeah, and I can't imagine that being a good solution, because when we were chatting here before we went on the recording, you know, people, drug use in a society is not something where you can just kind of shove it off and go like, well, why should I pay for this? Well, you will pay for it. You know, if you pay taxes to support prisons, then you will pay for it. And it's a very expensive hotel to stay in, even though the accommodation is not so nice. You know, it's very expensive. So, I mean, you end up paying for them there. They fill emergency rooms from out of need, right? You know, you pay for that's expensive. If you've been to an emergency room lately and walked in and saw on the chalkboard or the whiteboard that it's 9 hours, 10 hours wait, that's, you know, that's caused in part by this thing you don't want to pay for. So, I mean, I guess part of the problem is that this kind of research from getting the business of research, okay, we're talking about like how you actually get a project from inception to findings and publications. The business model would involve a couple things. One, you would have to get money, because money drives the thing, drives the business, the research business, right? If you can get researchers to change their name and their identity because you drive a truck full of money up and say, here's money to research this. So every what, 3 or 4 times a year, the government, and this is just public funding, forget private funding, which we don't have a good picture of. But I mean, in terms of public funding, right, they say, here's what we're funding. So you'll find people will change their research focus to go where the money is, because that's good business in academe, right? That's how you get better raises and get better prestige and all that kind of thing. But I've never seen any grants for studying this, for studying the impact of psychedelics. The second part of the business model is you got to get ethics approval to do that research. And I can imagine, based on what psychedelics are and you know, putting that into the existing framework of research, it'd be a tedious, really tedious process, and would have a lot of transaction costs attached to it. Like, it would take more human power, more time to create something that could be approved by an ethics research board. So that's another deterrent, right? Because you have to put in, that's so much overhead in your research project. So it would be very arduous. So I can see how these are impediments to get going. But, you know, I think everything gets co-opted, right? If there's resistance now, somebody will figure out a way that they can make money doing it. And then it will become more mainstream, and suddenly it will be embraced.
Well, and you set precedents as well, too, right? Like, if the first person that comes to an ethic board is wanting to do a study on psilocybin or LSD, and everyone's slow dragging their feet, they don't want to be caught up in something, and then the second, third, fourth, fifth, everything seems to get a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But one thing I want to talk to you about, that you are a professor of ethics. Mm-hmm. What ethical dilemmas do you see within psychedelics?
In terms of, like, for example, in the research part, getting to the point where we could actually deploy this as a legitimate treatment for something, or at least getting to the point where we can decide if it is or not, right? Part of the biggest issue in research ethics, based on our history, of course, is impatient consent or participant consent. So you have to be able to, if you're doing a research project, you have to be able to describe exactly what was going to happen to the patient, to the subject, and then you have to be able to give them opportunities to bail out at any point, right? They can say stop, and it's stop. Mm. You won't have that. Now, there's exceptions to this, of course, but psychedelics would definitely be an exception to that. So now there's already more work. There's already more challenge to that in terms of how do you establish consent and how do you maintain consent, right? Whereas the person will probably be out of capacity depending on the dosage and what you're doing and so forth, but you could probably conceivably put yourself subject into a position where they're not capable of consenting or withdrawing consent, and it would be very unpredictable. So that would be that's an interesting feature to it. But I mean, in terms of ethics on the other side of it, if you have a cure, or you have a new medication, or you have some kind of new intervention into an illness, the fundamental question we ask is it better than what we already have? Mm-hmm. Now, lots of stuff has hit the market that is not better than what we already have, right? So there's some corruption in the system. But here, we have a situation where what we have isn't working. I don't think there's any confusion, ambiguity about that feature. I think everybody basically, including people who are really dedicated and working in it, say, this isn't working. This is broken.
Isn't the research kind of pointing that it's 50% like placebo versus antidepressant medication?
for SSRIs?
Yeah. There was Irving Kirsch is a psychologist, and he did a big study, or he did a review of all the literature on SSRIs. Because a lot of it was publicly funded, he could put in a Freedom of Information Act request, and he got access to the data. And he's a psychologist of high regard, so he was able to review it and look at what it is. And he found that basically SSRIs and placebos were 50-50. But that wasn't included in the literature, of course, right? It was just focused on, like, it's effective. And of course, it's like, well, no. And, part of the effect of that is, what he suggests anyway, is that if you take it, the medication, right, by the virtue of the fact that you're taking control over your illness, or you feel like you are, right, you're doing something about it,
psychosomatic,
that level of self-efficacy has basically the same effect as the drug itself biochemically, right? The pharmacodynamics are not that significant. But the act of somebody taking charge of this thing that's legitimately debilitated them makes them miserable, but they're doing something about it, that's the feed. That's the actual effect. Then, that's the positive effect. It's not the pill. What's in the pill? So, give them sugar, give them SSRIs.
Mm. Right. And that is like, a true test of capitalism on smoking vapors, where you're just like, you know, I'm selling you flat out snake oil right now. And you know, and the funny thing is, like, the vast majority of patients that we interact with, almost everyone has an SSRI. And that's an antidepressant, things like, you know, Prozac, Paxil, Cipralex. Yeah, you know, like, everybody and their family members is being put on these as just sort of like a staple. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not feeling too good today? Here you go. Let's put you on a script at this.
Well, not only that, but like, everything's kind of changed, right? Like, amitriptyline was really popular a little bit before that. And then lithium was the most popular before that.
Well, and everything has fads, right? You go through this. And amitriptyline actually is fairly reasonable. It's just, unfortunately, it's super dangerous.
I was going to say, the problem is you shouldn't give people who are depressed and suicidal on medication that you can usually overdose
on. And I've had a couple people overdose on that. That is crazy. Mm. They're sitting there talking. All of a sudden, they go into VTAC. You're like, oh, wow, I watched that happen. That's nuts.
And the other thing is that they talk about SSRIs as like a minor, like a frontline intervention, relatively minor type of, that's the spirit of it, right? That's the indications or the description of it. But I have colleagues who study this, and they say that the withdrawal factor is very real and not recognized. And there's more and more literature starting to pile up about, like, this thing actually has a withdrawal effect. You, even for a taper, you can't do.
We see that a lot, actually, when people say, you know, I didn't like taking my medication because it was making me feel off, so I just stopped taking it, and now I'm feeling awful. I want to jump in front of a bus. It's incredibly common. Like, we see it on the front line more so than what I would say a lot of primary care physicians or even eMERGE docs would really see, because we're in the thick of it and we're actually experiencing it, and they disclose that to us, because a lot of times they'll change, like, a lot of patients will change their story once they get to the hospital because they don't want to be committed on a cycle. They really don't. Right.
No.
The other question that I had too with the ethics side of the research of this, would you say it's challenging as well because psychedelics have a pretty noticeable effect in comparison to a placebo? So doing double blind studies is challenging in this space?
For sure. There's not going to be much ambiguity about who's on and who's off, right? And you want it to be, you just have to change the design trial. Like, it's just, some things are impossible to have double blind, randomized controlled things. That's the gold standard, but it's not the only standard. Mm-hmm. So they would simply have to acknowledge that limitation and do it differently. It doesn't mean that the data would be useless. It just means probably it would take longer. And I think the thing I'm not saying that probably should say now is, you know, there's stigma, right? I mean, it's still of all the drugs we approved to study in all the universities and all the hospitals in Canada, this one still has that, you know, I don't want to Tim Leary again, but I mean, people have that image of, you know, that it's out of control or somehow it's subverting social rules or it's going to be dangerous in some fashion, right? Like, people are going to lose their connection to reality, which is always a big thing too. As much as we, as a universal human condition, seem to want to alter our consciousness, there's another group of people who are very concerned about being out of touch with what they consider to be reality, right? That's so people fear dementia as a mental illness, as a cognitive decline, because they literally will be out of touch with reality. They won't recognize people they've known their whole lives and so forth. That touches a really raw nerve with people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why dementia is kind of the thing. I think you talk about all the age-related declines or conditions you could develop later in life, if we were to rank them about what you're most scared of, right? I think for a lot of people, dementia would be top of the list because of, you know, you lose your mind, right? Or you go, when you're gone, your way out, you don't know what's happening. And that's what people fear that. So I think that by connection, that fear, when you start talking about, we want to research this particular medication, we need research ethics approval, and we need money, and we need all this stuff. Pitching that to people who control those things, I think there's that stigma back there that will be an impediment and something people who in this space will have to plan to overcome, you know, as they pitch forward in terms of money, in terms of ethics approval.
Well, and it's funny too that they're saying that like 80% of Canadians support the use of psilocybin in some capacity for medical aid. And I know, and right now we interviewed Spencer Hoxwell from Therasil. And they're training therapists on how to use psilocybin to deal with end-of-life anxiety.
Yeah.
So people who are palliative. And those all came from, like, I believe Roland Griffith was doing that, studies out of John Hopkins and so forth, with really incredible efficacy. Mm-hmm. And so this comes down to another ethical question, is that if these things have been with us since the dawn of civilization, if we may say that, whatever mm-hmm. people choose to quantify that, mm-hmm. is that do governments have the right to tell us not to do this, to tell us not to have something that can help so deeply, and especially someone who's dying, like right now for the Article 56 exemptions, a special access program, people who are actively dying are waiting like 200 days to get an exemption. And the question is that, does the government have the right to tell us not to? And it's an interesting perspective. Arguably, yes, I guess they do. But at the same time, from the human condition, this is a right that I have being a human, like Homo sapien. Who do you think you are to tell me that I can't do this to help myself? And, you know, what does that even mean?
You know, the concept of liberty has gotten really beat up over the last little while. I assume this coming, we're talking before Canada Day here is now. So I'm assuming the Canada Day weekend in Ottawa will be another show like that. But the reality, I mean, the basic conception of democracies are that, you know, the government is there to, you know, they regulate things because they're risky, because they can't be, you know, we should be free to pursue things, but they have the right to restrict our access to things that might be injurious to ourselves or others. But when you talk about, so that was the guise under which they regulated drugs. Now, some of the other motivations behind drug regulation, I mean, let's talk the history of this, right? It's driven not by concern for people or driven by a concern for people that we would share now, right? I mean, the history of regulation of marijuana was driven by wildly racist, explicitly racist things. I used to read teach a class at Western, haven't done it for a couple of years, but I used to teach a history of drug use in the West. And, you know, I have a book, I got it from City Lights, actually. It's a copy of The Black Candle. And it was the Commonwealth's first female judge, Emily Murphy, who's also a statue. She's memorialized in a statue for women's rights and women's right to vote in Ottawa. You can go into the area there and see her with the other key figures in Canadian feminist history. But she was also, like everybody, she has these great virtues and she has these horrible vices. And she was so racist against Asian people, right? She felt that they were the root of all vice in Canada. So she was wickedly racist and biased. So much so that, you know, at some point I was reading to the students from, here's the stuff that was said out loud about the reason why cannabis and opioids should be banned. And I would read to them. At some point I was like, I gotta stop reading this in class. It's so vile as to make me, and I mean, I want to challenge people and push their button. I didn't say it, it's not me. This is the fact. So you need to know this. But at some point it's like, man, this is so bad. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that drove prohibition movements anyway, was these ridiculous fears driven by racism or xenophobia and that kind of thing. So psychedelics, I mean, you know, if we remember that that's the feature, that that's the background behind all of this going forward, right? Now, I mean, they can restrict access to certain drugs that are dangerous, but in the context you just offered, right? Palliative care, you don't harm people in palliative care, but if the research is pretty clear that this is a useful intervention for them, then why is it still not allowed? And why is it such a slow process? Because technically speaking, if there's a treatment available and it's indicated for me medically, then I should have access to it. Unless there's some kind of shortage for other reasons, not because it takes 200 days to process paper. So that's a major, I would imagine people in healthcare would tell me that this is a problem just beyond this particular context. But yeah, that's a major problem, and that needs to be rectified. And it's not ethical. It's not appropriate when, you know, care is supposed to be provided. This is care, but for other reasons that aren't ethically considered, it's not harmful. It's not, there's no other problem blocking it. Then why is it slow? Well, why is it not available?
You know, going back to sort of the war on drugs concept, you know, there's a book called Chasing the Scream mm-hmm. by Yohan Hari, and it gets into that whole concept of, like, you know, we used to be able to buy heroin as a cough suppressant mm-hmm. and cocaine elixirs to pep you up. And, like, and obviously the original mixture of Coca-Cola had basically the coca leaf in it. Mm-hmm. And so it is funny that up until really quite recently, we were coexisting with drugs. And yes, people would be addicted, but mm-hmm. at the same time, nowhere near to the rate of addiction that we currently have. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, and the whole book gets into the idea that it was profoundly racially motivated. Mm-hmm. You know, I think cannabis was sort of associated with Mexicans and heroin with sort of African-American jazz musicians and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it just became this full-blown attack on minorities in the country. Mm-hmm. And then just sprawled, and the Americans, you know, post-World War II, they did fundamentally run the world. Mm-hmm. And just threw their way into it. If you want to be our friend, you're going to ban this. And a lot of countries, there was... It wasn't even ambiguity. It was just there was no legal association with a lot of psychedelics and other drugs. You know, like I think it was in Japan, you could buy psilocybin mushrooms at a store, and then the Olympics were coming up and the Americans were like, listen, we don't want to have, you know, we don't want to have an Olympics here if you're going to be selling drugs in a store. And then all of a sudden they're banned and so forth. And, and it's funny the influence that American, you know, theocracy has on the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And continues to do so.
Yeah. And I mean, the racism, let's just add another layer to it, right? A lot of the dialogue, a lot of the discussion, that was open parliamentary debate was about like, look, drugs are going to, you know, Chinese Canadians, or not even Chinese Canadians, they were Chinese immigrants or whatever, people who worked on the railway, this venom, this problem we're having in society, right? The worst part is what really should make everybody afraid is that they're going to convince your daughters, your white daughters, right, to get involved with them. And they're going to turn them out on the street. They get them hooked on opium, and then they're going to put them out on the street, and they're going to lose their sexual purity and their, you know, all that. So they, like, you know, you take like racism, very compelling at the time, but you pack in like, you know, this Victorian notion of, yeah, you protect your daughters and so forth. You know, who could not have felt in the time? Who could, you know, there'd be lots of people who might have been indifferent, but man, if this is going to cause my daughter to become a prostitute, then I'm not for it, right? I mean, if you could be convinced of that, and people were.
Well, and I find it vaguely ironic that, you know, don't get me wrong, opium does stem from sort of Afghanistan, these areas and stuff like that. But opium was introduced to China predominantly by the British. You know, which is
inconvenient history there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know what I mean? Like, and really, like, I actually.
So speaking of that, because I think that's a good segue for part two of this episode, because we're going to take a break here. This is part one of our podcast episode with Ken Kirkwood. I think when we come back for part two, we're going to talk a little bit more about the history of all of these substances. Cause I mean, we kind of touch base on it throughout this episode, but I think you're bringing up a lot of good points and topics, and we should maybe do a little bit of a chronological
of
history.
Western culture and, yeah, the nonsense accompanying that.
Yeah, exactly.
British colonialism at its finest.
So since this is part one, Ken, is there anything you want to plug, pluggable wise? Have you written any books? Anything you want to direct anybody's attention towards?
No, let's see. No, I'm basically, you know, you can find everything I've written basically on Google Scholar. I don't have anything particular right now to plug, but this is still fun.
And if anybody wants to attend your lectures, you're teaching at the University of Western Ontario.
University of Western Ontario, that's right.
Again, the episode's been sponsored by Vail Scientific. It'd be found at vailscientific.com. Adam, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, man, honestly, I could sit here and talk to you for another 4 hours, but we don't want to have 2-hour episodes. People get all weird about it. So
exactly. All right. Well, thanks again, Ken.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Nice. Take care.